Okay, looks like we're going to do this today also, because they didn't seem to have fixed the on. Okay. What? Well, it was on for a while and it was making a noise, that's about it. So I don't think. Yeah, when I first came, it, yeah, see. I'll make that noise and will realize it's kind of hard and shut itself off. These are all intelligent systems. Okay, so you should be able to see this, and if you are in the back, look the other side. There's one more on that side. So are there any questions before we continue? Well, that's thanks to you, because you asked us to check. Okay, it's shutting so far. Okay, so what I plan to do is to complete the discussion of query processing in data aggregation. Last class, I kind of motivated the issues, talked about the fact that you have, there are the fact that all of query processing and data aggregation involves selecting sources correctly, and to do that you need statistics, variety of statistics on the sources, and those statistics are not likely to be given by the sources, so you probably have to gather them yourself. So you can call that gathering learning if you want, but basically you need to probe and get that information. And one of the points I made, and I'm going to kind of make it more clearly today, is once you get the statistical information, there's this question of whenever you have statistical information about sources, there is the issue of how much information do you want to keep, and how accurate is the query processing going to be based on the statistics you kept. So that's one of the places where you would like to cut down the amount of statistics that you have to keep. And to do that, you need to remember the information with respect to not single queries, but with respect to query classes. And a point I made last time, which will sort of hopefully come back again today, is these query classes may well be defined differently for different types of statistics. Okay. Having said all that, I started talking about the first type of statistics, which was the overlap statistics, coverage and overlap statistics. And I was doing that discussion in the context of BibFinder, and then I pointed out that if you have the entire set of coverage and overlap statistics for a given query with respect to all source sets, so you can think of all these statistics to be of the form probability of a set of source, a subset of sources given a query, where the subsets can be singletons, in which case that just becomes overlap over a single source, which is the coverage of that source. Okay, and if you are larger and larger subset, then you have higher order statistics. Okay, then we mentioned last time that if you have this information, then you can at least you can use that to optimally select the top k sources, which will give the most number of tuples for the query. Okay, and then in fact, to do it optimally, it's still an NP-complete problem, but you can also do it greedily, which is a reasonable thing. And what we do in this greedy application is to compute what is the residual coverage of source 3 given that you have the query Q and you already accessed source 1 and source 2. And so you could do that as coverage of source 3 with respect to query Q, which is the number of tuples it will give, minus all the tuples that it's giving that are also given by any of the individual sources. And if you stop there, you have actually discounted some parts more than once, and so you add up the triple overlap, and then if you do all the triple overlaps, then if there are more than n sources, you may have to do the quadruples and so on. Okay. The interesting thing is that in general, I was showing this slide last time. In general, you can think of each query now is a vector of this type. Each single query can be remembered, I mean, the statistics for that query can be remembered as a vector of these numbers. The coverage with respect to all the sources, the pair-wise overlaps of all the sources with respect to that query, the triple-wise overlaps of all the sources with respect to the query. Now, as given, that's an exponentially large vector, but you could do several things to cut down its size. One is you can just assume that I'll only keep low-order statistics, so I can go only up to coverage and forget about overlaps, or I'll go only up to overlaps. So in fact, here is an interesting point. If I just have coverage and forget about overlap statistics, it turns out that I can actually generate overlap statistics by making assumptions about the sources. So for example, if the probability that a tuple belongs to source 1 is 0.5, and the probability that that tuple belongs to source 2 is 0.3. What's the easiest way of computing the probability that the tuple belongs to both source 1 and source 2?
Multiply them.
Yes, multiply. Now, when you multiply them, you don't have to remember multiplication, right? You don't have to remember the multiplication statistics anywhere. Do you understand this? Okay. So, the question is, when can I just compute the overlap statistics by multiplying them out? What am I doing when I multiply? And what is the assumption I'm making? Independence. What independence am I making? So the tuples are distributed independently over sources. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if in fact all the, to a first order approximation, if all the overlaps between sources can be characterized in terms of tuples being distributed independently over sources, then you can just remember the coverage statistics. So now the size of the vector would be only n, not 2 power n, where n is the number of sources. And you can still compute this. You can still compute that formula, right? Because under the assumption that everything is distributed independently, this S3 and S2 given Q is PS3 given Q times PS2 given Q, which numbers you have already. Okay? So, in fact, you can actually with one fell swoop, by making the assumption of independence, you can just get rid of all the higher order statistics. Just keep the coverage statistics. Okay, now this is not the first time we made assumption of independence, and everywhere else we made assumption of independence, we won. You know, I mean, we won, we made the assumption of independence of dimensions in vector ranking, and we won there. It was totally bogus assumption, we won there. We made the assumption of independent attributes in the case of naive Bayes classifier, we won there too. So, you know, you could try that here too. Okay, so despite the fact that I will tell you a lot about how to keep track of these overlap statistics, there is this possibility that you may not need them at all. You know, if in fact in your particular scenario, the overlap can be characterized in terms of independence, you would be better off. I mean, you'd get the same accuracy whether you kept the first n coverage statistics or you kept n square statistics including coverage and overlap. And the individual coverage and pairwise overlap. Okay. Now, and then, you know, there are other ways of cutting down the size too, which is you could just say, well, I would not keep anything more than the pairwise overlap. Forget about triplewise, etc. And most, in fact, pretty much you don't need to keep anything beyond pairwise to get a reasonable accuracy. Okay. Having said that, however, I will actually continue and explain to you how we could keep the statistics around both for coverage and overlap, but keep this point about independence in mind. Okay. Okay, now, so the this is all messed up. So this basically is the overall picture, you know, with respect to BigFinder. What we want to do is keep track of some statistics about coverages and overlaps, and given a query, you use them to decide which subset of sources to call. You know, if I give you K to be 4, then which are the top 4 sources to call? That's what you're trying to do. Okay. Before I explain to you these things about query lists and so on, let me give you this slide, which is issues in storing and using the statistics. Okay. So storing statistics for each query is disadvantageous, first of all. Okay, there are multiple issues going on here, and I just hope you keep these in different, these are different dimensions. There's a one question which is having to keep statistics for independent individual queries. A different issue is having to keep overlap statistics for each query. That worsens things more, okay? So now in this particular case, what I'm, until now I've been talking about, you know, how to get away without using hopefully higher order overlap statistics. But even if I somehow decided to keep whatever number of overlap statistics I want, there's still an issue of how do you store them with respect to queries. The obvious idea would be that every individual query would have a vector corresponding to these overlaps. That would be problematic in two different reasons. One is there are too many queries, okay, and second is there is no guarantee that the queries that you will see tomorrow are the queries that you've already seen today, okay? So you would like to be able to keep the statistics such that when a new query comes, even if you haven't seen this query before, you can still guess what is its coverage and overlap likely to be. If not, learning would be a rote learning. That means I've seen this previously, and so this is the right thing to do. Okay? So there are actually two ideas there. I changed the slides, but I couldn't download them. The two ideas we'll use is one, to reduce the number of queries that we need to deal with, we'll just worry about those queries that have been frequently asked. Okay? Frequently asked also means they've actually been asked even once. Okay? So queries that have never been asked. Now, you know, if you're talking about BigFinder, right, you have essentially queries on author names, titles, years. So any query that I can make up on that is a separate query now. So I'm saying now that I would not, that would be too many independent, individual queries. So I might just say, I'll only keep statistics for frequently asked queries. So hopefully the ones that have been asked previously are likely to be asked. Those are the kinds of things that will be likely to be asked again. So that's the first point. So to do that, what we wind up doing is we'll keep a query list, okay, a log of queries, and essentially do all our statistics with respect to that log. Okay. The second is that you would store statistics not with respect to independent individual queries, but query classes. Not individual queries, but query classes. Okay. Now, so these statistics basically, when I say statistics, I mean the statistics vector. Now, the issue of how big should the statistics vector be is left, is a separate issue. I can have it just as big as n, where n is the number of sources, or n square, where n is the number of sources, or 2 power n, where n is the number of sources. Okay, so that's an independent issue. So now the question is, so this basically brings up the possibility that I'm just going to cluster queries. I mean, how would I make queries into query classes? I have to say, put, you know, this set of queries is one class, this set of queries is another class. Okay? The obvious thing you would want to do is use some sort of a clustering technique to decide which are the query classes. Now, the first obvious thing to note is when you are clustering queries now, you're going to be clustering them using the query vectors that we now have. The query vectors are not the content vectors, but the statistics vectors. So this was something that I was mentioning last time, that so when you wind up clustering queries, you may wind up finding that two queries about two database conferences are not in the same cluster, while a query about a database conference and a query about an AI conference is in the same cluster. okay, and that would just fall out naturally as long as you define your, you know, remember what was the most important thing for clustering? Distance, okay? You define your distance in terms of your statistics vector, not in terms of the keywords. Then you're in good shape, okay? So, having said that, so in fact, this slide basically shows that I have maintained a list of queries that people have asked the BitFinder system. Okay, and those are the lowest level specific queries. And for each of those, I have this kind of statistics vector. Now the question is, cluster these queries, and then for each cluster associate a query vector, a statistics vector, which is sort of some sort of an aggregate of the vectors of the independent individual queries. Okay, just like centroid of a cluster. Okay, you could do that. And then that's all nice, so you will have as few clusters as you want, and if you have fewer clusters, you have fewer statistics, and when a new query comes, you essentially just have to map it to a cluster. Everything is fine and dandy until you realize that when the new query comes, how do you know which cluster it's supposed to be mapped to? You understand what I'm saying? It looks nice until all I said till now looks nice. You just cluster them, and then there are groups, and a new guy comes, you just put them into a group. The question is, how did you decide, you know, which cluster is going to be the right cluster for the guy who is coming in? The obvious idea would be to find the query, the vector. The obvious idea would be to find the statistics vector for the new guy, and then find its distance from each of the centroids. Always understand the dumb way of doing it before you understand the better way, because you would not appreciate the better way if you don't understand the dumb way. And if you don't understand the dumb way, you will discover it, you know, when you're sleepy. So the obvious dumb way would be that you would basically call the, you know, you get the query, the coverage overlap vector for the new query, essentially. Find the distance between it and the centroids of all the clusters, and whichever is the closest, you put it in that cluster. Looks great, except it's a dumb idea, because you're trying to put it in a cluster so that you don't have to find out the coverage and overlap for this query. And the only way you can find out the coverage and overlap for this query is to call all the sources upfront. If you did that, then you can ignore the entire statistics issue and just say, you know, I know all the answers now, and I'm done. So do you see the circularity here? This is why what you need to do in essence is you have to, so this is this last part. Clustering directly on queries won't work. That's what I'm saying here, because you don't know when a new query comes which cluster it belongs to. Okay, so one idea would be that try to actually have a characterization of each cluster in terms of In BitFinder, ultimately, in any data aggregation scenario, ultimately, all the queries are selection queries. Okay, so what you might do is you may be able to compare the selection values of the new query with the aggregate selection values of the queries in different clusters. And one way of doing that, it turns out, that we tried out, is not to cluster the queries at all, but cluster the attributes. So each query is essentially, this attribute should have this value, this attribute should have this value. Okay? So if you were to cluster the attributes, then when a new query comes, it would be easier to see how, what it binds versus what the, you know, where its binding would fall in each of the attribute value clusters. Now, if I have the attribute value clusters, if I take a cross product of them, then I have the query classes. So I now define query classes indirectly in terms of attribute clusters. Okay, so the idea is to be able to say that if you ask me, you know, a database conference, I mean, you say sigmod, then I might find an intermediate, I may not have an actual sigmod query in the past, but I might have a higher level database conferences query, and I would use that guy's statistics to be your statistics. Okay, so this ultimately is the trickiest part in whatever I'm explaining here, which is to realize that what you want to learn is not query clusters, but attribute clusters, which will then define the query cluster. Now, when you're defining attribute clusters, actually there's a name for these are called subspace clusters. So attributes, a query is essentially are vectors in the dimensions of the attributes. Right? If you are finding clusters around queries, so that's a bigger space clustering, and what we're doing is we're doing clustering on the individual sub-dimensions. Okay, so you're trying to do subspace clustering on that. So that's what we would do. We would learn attribute value hierarchies for each of the attributes. And then I learn the hierarchies, I do the clustering. What clustering would I do for hierarchies? Hierarchical agglomerative clustering, something that we know. And you do that on the attribute value hierarchies, on the attribute values. And remember, when you're doing the clustering, you need a distance. And for the distance, you would use the distance between the vectors, the distribution vectors, the statistics vectors. Okay? So I would do this, and then I will get the AV hierarchies, the cross product of those would be the query classes, and then I can prune some of the query classes away if certain query classes have too few queries under them, so that I will remember statistics only for frequent query classes. Okay? By changing the thresholds that I keep for the frequent query classes, I can keep much fewer or much more statistics. So it's just a kind of, and the more the threshold, the fewer the statistics kept, the less the accuracy of the statistics. Okay. So that's the basic idea. So this is basically what the attribute value hierarchy is. That's attribute value hierarchies and a query classes. So if you have multiple hierarchies, one for let's say the year and one for the conference, then the hierarchy for query classes is the Cartesian product in essence of the two hierarchies there. So I don't have to actually keep it directly. Okay. Now the only thing is I showed it here in such a way that sigmod ICDE and the intermediate node, I wrote it as DB, databases. Now that's just to make you happy. In fact, as I pointed out to you, if you were to do this kind of a clustering, all you're going to find is the conferences which are distributed similarly over the sources would be closer together. That means they would be part of the same subtree. So in the actual hierarchy that we get, you are likely to have a database conference and an AI conference together. And that's perfectly all right. So actually, just to show that I'm not making this up, here is actually one of the conference hierarchies that you would learn, Nie learned based on his analysis, using just direct application of hierarchical agglomerative clustering. And you notice, and this is just the tree representation in an indented fashion. It's a hierarchy, right? So you'll notice that here, for example, IEEE computer and ICML are together. So there is some branch of this hierarchy where the two closest siblings are ICML and IEEE computer, which is like saying sigmod and IIII are close. Okay? So it's ultimately what we are doing is we are not actually deciding who comes close to which. The distance function decides which comes close to which. Okay. Now going back to this, let's see. So that's attribute value hierarchies. And so what we would do in computing these essentially is you would get the attribute values. And now actually there's a tricky issue, which is how do you even know what are all the possible values for an attribute? Okay, these are things you take for granted if you have the database next to you. Okay, because the database will tell you the domains of all the attributes. If it's somebody else's database, you don't even know the domain. Okay. So that too comes from the probing. Based on the values that you have seen in the past, you know the domain. Okay. So start with those and then cluster the similar attribute values where the clustering distance metric is in terms of the two vectors. Now, what we use in this case is essentially a direct Euclidean measure. Okay, which is a reason of, which is more reasonable here than in vector space ranking, because all numbers are between 0 and 1 anyway to begin with, because all the probability, so it's like the frequencies are all in some sense sort of the biggest problem with Euclidean distance is the normalization effect, which wasn't as much of an issue for us. Okay. So anyway, so we use directly Euclidean distance measure between the two vectors. Now notice that that would be defined for the number of dimensions that you do have. And if you only are keeping n dimensions, then it will be over n dimensions. If you are keeping 2 power n, then it's a longer vector. So you use that, and then you get the AV hierarchies. And actually in the paper that you'll see that he plays around with some more stuff. After the actual hierarchies are made, he flattens them. This is something that you can do for any hierarchical agglomerative clustering method. If you feel that your hierarchy is too deep and you want it to be shallower, then you can start arbitrarily merging some of the subtrees. And you could do that based on how tight is the cluster. Okay, and the tightness of the cluster could be defined in terms of the average distance from the centroid of all the elements of the cluster. I won't even go into the details here, but essentially the effect of that, this step is, you have a hierarchy like this, you might be able to merge by removing C1 out and putting A1 and A2 up directly. So after you did the hierarchical agglomerative clustering, you're trying to flatten the hierarchy. Okay, and whether or not you do that is not going to have a major effect on the way you're learning the statistics. It's more of an efficiency issue. And then after that, you now have the attribute value hierarchies, and their cross product implicitly defines the query classes. And as I said, I want to cut down some of the query classes. And remember, the vectors only for the ones which are frequent. Now, ultimately, a frequent query class, to talk about frequent query classes, you have to have some sort of a threshold idea. So a class is considered frequent if it has more than k queries in it, where k is the number that you pick. Okay? The bigger the k, the fewer the frequent classes. The smaller the k, the more the frequent classes. K equal to 1, then everybody is a frequent class. Now, one interesting thing, in fact, I won't again go into the details here, is this idea of frequent sets, it's easy to understand, but doing it efficiently is tricky. Okay, so one of the issues is if I have just found out that a query class, a higher level query class, is already infrequent, is there any point in seeing which of its children query classes should be kept? There's no point. If you try it, you would still find that whatever belongs to this query class is split among its children query classes. Okay? So you want to use that sort of information, that in fact, frequent query classes, the property of whether or not a query class is frequent would have this anti-monotonicity property. That means if your parent is not frequent, then you are not frequent either. You can use this to cut down some of the processing. Okay, again, that's also below the hood. I hope you would understand is you do some thresholding to decide which number of query classes to keep. Okay, and then finally, you have the query classes that you're going to keep. And for each of them, you have to compute the aggregate statistics vector. And there you just do basic centroid. So you take the, remember at the time when you're doing this, you started from the individual queries. Right? So you know for each query class, you know which queries actually belong to that query class in the query log. And for which you do have the statistics, you compute the weighted vector for those. Okay, and then keep this. After you do this, you can throw away the query logs. All you need is the query classes and the query vector. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about doing this way is it's possible that if you look at the query class, okay, if you look at the query class like this, it's possible that some sides of the query class hierarchy, the most frequent, the last frequent query class is like here. After that, nothing below it is a frequent one. For some others, you go much further down. That depends on, so for example, if there are more queries about certain types of papers versus less queries about certain other types of papers, then you would wind up remembering more statistics and much more higher level of granularity for the ones that are frequently accessed. Okay? So it's just the thresholding essentially makes sure that the cutoff for this query classes is non-uniform. So remember that any frequent query class idea would be if you take this hierarchy and you're kind of cutting away some of the leaves and saying those I won't remember the statistics. Right? The question is, are you cutting it away at the same level across, or is it thought of like that? And all I'm saying is it could be like this. Because whatever the actual query access frequency of the query is, that would determine which would you keep. Okay. Okay. So now we have everything ready. All I need to do is, given a new query, I could essentially decide which query classes can it be mapped to. Okay. Now, that depends on what are its attribute values. So what are the attribute values that are bound in this new query? And based on the attribute values that are bound in this new query, you know, basically, you know which parts of these hierarchies are highlighted by that query. And the cross products over that would be the query classes. Now, it is possible that the query classes that are actually remembered here, the frequent query classes that are remembered here, the specific query would not likely to be there, not likely to be there. But subsets of them might be frequent query classes in this hierarchy. So what you would do is you would take the statistics of those classes and combine them, weighted combination. Okay? So that's what is done in this step. So mediator estimates the statistics for the query using the weighted sum of the statistics of the mapped classes. And this is business of what classes do you map the query to. That was made easy because we had attribute value hierarchies rather than the query classes directly. Okay? Good. So, and then once you have the statistics, I already told you how to rank the queries. So you can pick the first source to be the one which has the highest coverage, and the second source to be the one which has the highest residual coverage given the first source, and so on. Okay? So the numbers you have in front. And please remember that in doing this, if you are making the independence assumption about distribution, then whenever you need to compute the overlap, you multiply out the numbers. If you don't, then you actually take the numbers that are stored and plug them in. Okay? So this is just a little about some of the evaluation for this thing. Let me see. I think all I want to show you is that the behavior is as expected. So for example, in this particular case, you're considering different thresholds in terms of what level of, I mean, so there are actually two thresholds in our statistics. One is, what is the minimum frequency that is needed before you keep statistics for a query class? The other threshold is, what is the minimum overlap you need before you consider the entry for that overlap to be zero versus non-zero? Okay, so you can vary both of them. And so in this case, actually, I think these are the different for the different frequency thresholds and different overlap thresholds, how the space in terms of number of numbers you remember will change, which is not surprisingly, it falls down quite drastically. Okay. And the other interesting thing is, well, you notice this one, the space can be reduced quite drastically by changing the frequency, the thresholds. Okay. Now the next one is the fewer statistics you remember, the more inaccurate your actual assessment of the query the new queries statistics are likely to be. So the question would be, how accurate is your assessment? And this is basically a post facto study. So I will, for each query, I guess what its the statistics vector is, okay? And I'll also compute the statistics vector by actually calling all the sources, okay? And then compare these two vectors in terms of their mean square distance, okay? And so that's what I'm plotting there, okay? And so you'll notice that the error increases, of course, as the amount of statistics reduced, the error increases. Error in terms of the assessment increases. But it doesn't increase anywhere near as steeply as the space consumption falls down. So that's kind of nice, okay? The other thing, let's see, okay. So the other thing finally is, one other point to make here actually is that the way you select the sources, the top k sources, is dependent on the relative magnitudes rather than the absolute magnitudes of the numbers in the source vector, on the numbers in the statistics vector. So this in some sense is the upper bound on how bad you can do. It's possible that you actually assessed your statistics vector to be slightly wrong, and yet the top k sources you would compute using the assessed vector versus the real vector would be the same. That's sort of like NBC computing the probabilities wrongly and yet getting the class correctly, right? So we also look, if you look at the precision in terms of what are the true top k sources that you should call and what are the, and how many of the true top k sources are actually called if you use this method. Now how do you know the true top k sources? Again, post facto. You send the query to all the sources and figure out what would have been the top five sources, knowing the full coverage and overlap. And so that's the top, real top five. And if I give you a five sources, you can talk about the precision of my five sources in terms of, you know, how many of the top five sources are in my five sources. If all of them are in, that's 100% precision. If it's only half of them, only two of them, it's 2/5. So that's the precision idea. And so you'd notice that, in essence, two things. One is, if you select randomly, the precision is very bad. Randomly are just based on the sizes and so on. I forget exactly what was this approach. I think it's a random selection of sources, which is what you would do if you don't keep track of any source characterization. Not surprisingly, the precision would be bad here. And if you keep the statistics, your precision is much higher. What's surprising, in essence, is notice that there are two lines always together. And that's kind of bad news. What they're saying is, one line basically says what happens if you keep all the overlap statistics apart from the coverage statistics. The other line says essentially, what if you just keep the coverage statistics and make the independent assumption? And the fact that those two are close, in essence, says for BibFinder, in fact, you are better off, you're just as well off keeping coverage statistics and making the independent assumption. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, this is sort of, the sources for BibFinder are not made by us. So people actually made DBLP and CSP, etc. So we don't really know whether they correlated or not. And, you know, in effect, it looks essentially like the distribution of tuples over them is close to being independently distributed. So if to actually show that statistics would help, if you have a correlation which is more than independent distribution. We actually did some experiments on controlled sources where you put the tuples into the individual sources. Okay, so I can decide to put, for these sources, I'll always put the same tuples in them. So it's no longer independent, it's highly correlated. And then for this set and this set, you would never put the same tuples in both of them. So they're completely disjoint. So remember that disjoint and fully correlated are both against independence. Okay, independent distribution means there would be some overlap. It's just that that overlap would be as given by the multiplication of the two original coverages. Okay, so this is essentially showing that if you were to keep the overlap statistics, and if in fact the sources were highly correlated, then they would help you. Okay, this is sort of like saying NBC would fail if attributes are in fact correlated. But in most cases, you can get away with the assumption that attributes are not correlated. Okay? So that's basically about learning the coverage overlap statistics. So what I want to do next is go on to a separate type of statistics, which is the latency one. And actually learning the latency statistics is somewhat easier because the query classes for them turn out to be simpler. Okay? But it's worth talking about them just because the query classes are different from the one for coverage and overlap statistics. Okay, so in this case, the idea is you're not just interested in finding the maximum number of tuples, you also may want to just get the tuples as fast as you can. Okay, and to do that, basically you need to decide which are the fast sources, which are the slow sources. Once again, just like coverage and overlap, you could have decided upfront for coverage that this is the biggest source, this is the second biggest source, this is the third biggest source, irrespective of the query, and just use the size of the sources to decide the ranking. That's size-based ranking. Okay. And similarly for latency too, I can just say this is the fastest source, this is the second fastest, this is the third fastest, and just call them in that order. That's one possibility. Okay. However, as I mentioned, latency does change even for the same source. And there are two ways it can change, at least we know of. One, of course, as I said, is the time of the day could matter on the internet. Depending on where the source is, depending on the time of the day, there may be higher versus lower latency. Okay. So you could decide to keep these, a bunch of numbers, one for the morning, one for the evening, one for the night. That's one way. Okay, it's all, whenever you're doing statistics, it's a question of what's the level of granularity at which you want to keep profiles of the sources. The other one that I'm actually going to discuss here more is that, in fact, the latency does depend upon queries, because the coverage and overlap depend on the queries earlier. So the question is, do latency statistics also depend on queries? The answer is yes, they do depend. Okay. However, they depend not on what they really depend upon, turns out, is the binding pattern of the query, which is, I mentioned what binding patterns are, right? Basically, if you don't understand binding patterns, just look at this here. So a binding pattern essentially is what are the attributes that are bound. That's all a binding pattern says. Okay? And you can think of that as a course-level characterization of query classes. So all queries which bind only the X attribute but not Y and Z attribute would be of the type BFF class. It's a bound free class. And then all queries which only bind Y and Z, not X, would be FBB class. Now, you can always go take these classes and split them further down. You know, BFF class, in the BFF class, what are the subset of bindings for the first one? And you can split it into different subsets. But we found that in general, the binding pattern is a good indicator of how long you're likely to take in terms of latency. Okay? And so these are actually some examples that show, in this case, that first of all, that top one shows that depending on the binding pattern, the average response time can be quite different. Okay, for the same source, depending on the binding pattern, the average response time can be quite different. Okay. And the second thing is, for a given binding pattern, notice that a binding pattern ultimately can correspond to multiple queries. Because, I mean, all I'm saying is I'm binding X. I could bind X to different values. And it's actually possible, in the worst case, that for each possible value of X, there's a different latency. Okay, all we are saying is, what's the lowest number of statistics we can remember and get away? Okay? So in this case, you would say that all this is showing is, for the given binding pattern, while the response time does change over queries, it more or less remains closer. So the variation here is closer than that variation. That's all we're saying. And for that, you actually basically... So with respect to binding patterns, the variation is lower. So if you remember the average latency for each binding pattern, that's a good way of figuring out how long a query is likely to take. Okay? Oh, okay. Now, the other thing is, this essentially shows that remembering statistics with respect to binding patterns does improve your estimation. Okay, so all this is saying is, what if, in fact, I remember a single number for each source in terms of its aggregate latency, and my friend remembers, 15 numbers for each source, one for each binding pattern for that source. Okay, am I doing better than my friend in terms of, in the only terms that matter, which is, given a query, I select K sources, he selects K sources, and I count the overall latency exhibited as the tuples keep coming to me. Okay, how much time for the first 5 tuples, how much time for the first 10 tuples, etc. Okay? And, in these issues, just as I showed earlier, in the case of BibFinder, with respect to keeping just coverage statistics and assuming independence versus keeping coverage and overlap statistics, the difference wound up being insignificant. Right? So that's the question here. And it turns out in this case, in fact, the difference is reasonably high. Okay, so the top one is remembering just query insensitive latencies, and the bottom one is remembering and using query sensitive latencies. Okay, now I notice that I didn't talk about the notion of learning of these numbers. That's because it's trivial. Okay, once I decide what my binding pattern, once I decide that I'm going to remember with respect to binding patterns, there can be much fewer binding patterns. For example, for the BibFinder, I think there were about 23 binding patterns that are distinct. Okay? And so, you just have to remember 23 numbers. And so, why bother? I mean, you can do clustering on that too, just as you did clustering earlier. But it's already reasonably high in terms of coarseness. Okay? So, all we do is send, 20 queries of binding pattern 1, compute the average latency, 20 queries of binding pattern 2, compute the average latency, remember these numbers. So that's the only things that you remember. Okay? So this essentially would be enough if all you're doing is trying to optimize the time to first k tuples. Time to first k tuples. And the other one would be enough if all you're doing is getting the maximum number of tuples in the first k sources. Right? The question is, what is a query processor actually supposed to do? Well, users can actually say, I want both high coverage and low response time. Okay? And in particular, essentially, there are, if I have one query plan which has high coverage, so it's clear that if all I'm interested in coverage, then I will like the high coverage plans more than low coverage ones. All I'm interested in is response time, then it's also clear that the low response time ones would be more preferred than the high response time. But if I'm interested in both of them, then I don't know how to compare plan 1, which has high coverage, high response time, and plan 2, which has low coverage, low response time. It depends. It's like basically the travel planning scenario. One plan which takes 2 days but only costs you $10, and other travel plan which takes you 2 hours but costs you $300. Which is better? It depends on, you know, everybody can have their own different metrics for deciding what is the, what they're trying to optimize. So the point that I'm trying to, the reason I got into here is, remember last time I was saying that once you get into the data aggregation scenario, query processing objective is not unique. You can essentially have multiple objectives that you're trying to optimize. Okay. Now the interesting thing is multi-objective optimization is something that, how many of you have heard of multi-objective optimization before? That's good. That's a large number already. So basically, if you have a single objective optimization, it's clear what is the real answer. Whichever is the if you had all the information, you know which is the real answer. Okay, you sort all the solutions with respect to this single metric. Whichever has the best value for this metric, that's the best solution. In the case of multi-objective, if all I say is these are the objectives, then in fact there's no single answer. All I have is a set of solutions that are non-dominated. Okay? And those are normally called Pareto sets. Okay? So the normal answer, the general solution for a multi-objective optimization problem is to give to the user the Pareto set. Okay? Pareto is a nice name. Actually, Pareto optimality essentially says that you can't, if you start with that solution and you try to make local changes to that solution, you can't improve one aspect of that solution without worsening another aspect. Okay? The only way you can get more optimal than the solution, so there's no obvious way you can improve both or improve one without changing the other. Okay? So really, all the solutions in the Pareto set are incomparable. And different people might like different things. Okay? So actually, it's nice to think of, I wish I can put this up. No, if I touch it, I don't know what happened. It's nice to think of, if you were, can people see what I'm writing here? Okay. Oh man, that's not good. Okay. So suppose I have two objectives. Objective one here, objective two here. Okay? So this could be response time. The x-axis could be response time, y-axis could be coverage. X-axis could be the time of travel, y-axis could be the amount of money you spent. Then each solution is going to be, each solution for this problem is going to be a point in this space. Okay? Now, if I put all the solutions there, all I'm saying essentially is, assuming that I made it in such a way that all objectives are ordered such that the larger the value of the objective, the better. If in fact smaller is better, take the negative of it, you know, then you'll be fine. Okay, then if you have all these solutions here, which is the Pareto set for those solutions? The top one, like that. Okay, so in essence, you would show these guys, those guys, to your user. Normally, if it is a continuous space, then you talk not in terms of Pareto solutions, but not in terms of Pareto set, but in terms of Pareto curve. So you have a Pareto curve of solutions, and you show it to the user and say, find your home in this, whichever you feel like, and then I'll give you that solution. Okay, so it's nice to actually realize that that there is this distinction that, you know, in multi-objective optimization, what is optimal itself is defined in terms of Pareto sets. Okay. Now, however, people don't like being given multiple solutions or being asked to decide which one. Okay, that's why travel agents just give you two extremes, and, you know, and in fact they decide which two to give you, and, you know, such that their commission is likely to be maximized, you know. So, and then you will pick the obvious one that they're hoping you will pick, and then they'll get the maximum commission. But anyway, so the point is, Pareto set is actually a painful thing to show to the user, you know. And in fact, there are nice theoretical results showing that for certain classes of problems, the size of the Pareto set could be exponentially large. Okay, but I won't even get into that. That's just, you know, the moment we started talking about multi-objective optimization, we went multiple layers higher into, and are talking about just optimization in general, as again as optimization with respect to a very specific problem that we have here. But it's nice to know that there is, you know, I assume that all of you know single objective optimization. So I never had to tell you that optimization means start, take, and take the best. Okay. But some of you at least may not know what the multi-objective scenario, what happens with optimization. Now, so the way you do it in that case is what? If people don't like to be shown sets, then you just combine objective 1 and objective 2 into a single number. Alpha times objective 1 plus beta times objective 2. Okay? And normally, many multi-objective problems, although they should be done this way, get done this way. So people will find some time figuring out some reasonable algebraic formula which can combine all the objectives into one single number. Show it around to people saying, are you okay with this? And the first 5 people say it's okay. Then for the rest of the time, that's the formula that they use to combine them. Okay. So you need to make sure that the way you're combining is sort of reasonable. It may not account for everybody's taste, but it's sort of reasonable. So what we do in our case is, for example, here is a metric for our specific problem, which is, remember that individual sources have different coverages. In fact, what is important is different residual coverages. And individual sources also have different latencies. Okay? Now, what I want is as many tuples as possible, as fast as possible. That's basically what I want. And that's a reasonable way of looking at the optimization issue here. So you could, if you could basically rank the sources, you know, in the first approach, we rank the sources only in terms of residual coverage and pick the first and the second and third. Okay? In the second one, which is a latency optimization, we rank sources only in terms of latency and pick the lowest, second lowest, third lowest. Now, the rank function, essentially, which I'll call the utility, is now sort of a function of both these numbers. And it should be directly proportional to the coverage, and it should be sort of inversely proportional to the latency. Okay? So, what we did basically in this case is you're taking residual coverage, multiply it by gamma power latency, where gamma is a number between 0 and 1. This is actually called a discounted model. This is called a discounted model. And it's just a special case of a more general issue that all of you are deciding, which is it better to take $10 today or $10,000 10 years from now? Which is better? Okay, I mean, and if, you know, those of you, if you ever actually won a lottery, apparently you have to make this decision, you know. I was really disappointed, not that I ever won a lottery, but I was really disappointed that they say that the jackpot is $3 gazillion billion, but if you take it as a lump sum payment, it's $10, something like that. You know, so the actual jackpot is given in pieces of 1 cent each or something until you die, and, you know, if you die fast, then you don't get most of the money. Okay, and in fact, if you want it right then they'll give you a lump sum payment. Okay. I've been watching very carefully what people are doing, and, you know, as to when they win the lotteries, and CNN reports this. You know, even if in fact there's a big earthquake in some other country, the lottery stuff is always in the front sheet. And I realized, based on my extensive investigation, that everybody goes for lump sum payments. Everybody seems to think they'll die tomorrow, And so they want to get right now money. Okay. So how can you make sense of it? What they're doing is they are considering the money now times gamma power the time. So the current lump sum payment will be given tomorrow. So I still have to wait until tomorrow. So gamma power the distance between now and tomorrow is one number. The other is gazillion billion dollars times gamma power, you know, 20 years. And all you are saying is, so they're discounting future with respect to current reward, which is a very reasonable thing to do. And all that changes from person to person is the gamma. Okay. The fact that you are all losers who are actually sitting in colleges means what? That you don't actually assume that immediate reward is the only thing. If immediate reward is the only thing, you should drop out of elementary school and go to McDonald's or something and make a career. Because that's money right now, as again as, you know, you keep on going through these boring lectures and hopefully you'll get bigger money. Okay? So all of us have different discounted reward functions. Some of us want more immediate rewards than others. And so the users are now shown this and say, change your gamma between 0 and 1. And that will change how much you are interested in coverage with respect to how fast you want that approach. Okay? And then there is other model. You know, we can try another model. I like this model because this is essentially normally how you do discounted rewards in many scenarios. It's a nice way of modeling discounted reward. Okay. So you think of the coverage as the reward and the time is basically the latency. It's a nice obvious connection. And another way of kind of combining these is just alpha plus beta. Except if, since they are not in the same units, one thing you could do is, you know, normalize them. So here you're essentially doing logarithm of residual coverage times, you know, negative of latency. And then now this is basically being multiplied by one single parameter, omega. If you have alpha and beta, all you can do is you can convert, you can say alpha plus beta equal to 1. And then there is only one parameter, which is omega. Okay, and then you just sit it around, you just shift it around. Okay, so these are, the point here is not that these models are the most important models in the world, but there are reasonable ways of combining these into a single objective, and then you just optimize it with respect to that. If you come here, all this stuff about Pareto sets you can throw out the window, right? Because you're converting apples and oranges into fruits, and that's it, you're done. Okay, so actually, so these slides, these pictures essentially show you that these models are reasonable. Okay, this model, this particular picture is for the discounted model, and this is for the summative model. Okay, all we are talking about ultimately, which is the right way, both of them are reasonable ways of combining coverage and overlap, coverage and latency. Okay, residual coverage and latency. And the issue is, and in both cases, users are allowed a leverage. You know, there's a meter, there's a parameter that they can shift around. The gamma can be made close to 1 or close to 0. Okay? So, and then similarly here, the omega can be made close to 1 or close to 0. Okay? This is basically just showing that, these are the different values of gamma. For each curve corresponds to a different value of gamma. Okay? And as expected, the larger the gamma, the less interested in immediate reward you are. So in essence, if gamma equal to 1, then would you take lump sum payment or would you wait for the biggest payment? Would you wait for the full payment? Gamma equal to 1 means $10,000 10 years from now is like $10,000 right now. There's no difference. And you know which is better. If I'm going to give you $10 or $10,000 now, which one would you rather take? I'm hoping all of you would say the same thing. Okay? So if gamma equal to 1, then all that matters is the coverage. Okay? And if gamma is smaller, then the more smaller and smaller the gamma gets, the more and more important the latency is. Right? And so For the different models, if you were to rank the sources and you actually were to pick those top K sources and you were to run them, and then you compute the average latency for the first K tuples, okay, you'll see that the lower values of gamma, the curves are lower. For the higher values of gamma, the curves are higher. And all the curves will increase because as more and more tuples come, it will take more and more time. But the question is, you are starting lower down. So this way, you did get so if you put gamma equal to 0.26, you started with, you really were interested in improving your latency. Now the problem is you may not get too many tuples on that way. So in fact, these are really three-dimensional plots. You have number of tuples, you have average latency, and you also have to talk about the coverage. And the coverage is actually being given here as the second argument. So what basically this is showing is for gamma equal to 0.26, the total coverage they got was what? Is that like 40%? No, it's like 0.04, so 4%. I can't even read this. Can you read it? He made these curves up. I don't know really. That's 80-something percent. Okay, so for gamma equal to 0.26, you got a total average coverage of 84%. Gamma equal to 0.76, it's 97% coverage. So that is, if you run it all the way, if you call all the sources and wait for all the tuples, then how many tuples did you actually get with respect to the maximum tuples you could have gotten if you were to call the best case sources in terms of just the coverage? Okay. So that's this side, and the same sort of behavior is also there on the other side. So both models are reasonable in terms of what they're doing. Now, so it's up to you to decide which one you would, for which you have better intuition. Because notice that the big magic now is I am saying that you, the user, has to think about what's important to you, and rather than write a big paragraph as to what's important to you, take the sliding scale and put the gamma at the right place. Because nobody really wants to hear paragraphs. You know, did any of you know that I once heard this story that University of Santa Cruz, has any of you gone to University of Santa Cruz, California, UC Santa Cruz? Apparently, they don't believe in numbers, GPAs. So for each course, they give a paragraph, which is a paragraph description of how you did in the course. Okay? And when people from UC Santa Cruz apply, then there is no average GPA for them. Okay? And so you just have to read these paragraphs, look for nuances. And clearly, you know that UC Santa Cruz people tend to go to grad school only in UC Santa Cruz because nobody else reads paragraphs. It's much nicer to have paragraphs, but we know that we all want to convert everything into numbers just so that it's just, you know, dumb but objective. It's dumb, but at least there's a thought in it. Okay, so the user's nuanced trade-off between coverage and response time should then be converted into, okay, I'm pushing this gamma, okay, I'll stop here. Between zero, here is zero, here is one, I'll stop here. And then, you know, once they do it, then all I do need to do is, okay, this is your best plan. Okay. One other nice thing actually is, I don't completely understand this, Jensen can probably explain to me if I'm misrepresenting him. This essentially shows the plans that are made for by the different models for different values of gamma. Now remember that each of the plans should be a point in the two-dimensional space like this, right? Right? And the only question really is ask yourself the following question. If there are things like this, then ultimately the Pareto curve would be the top boundary. Okay? Now, what I want to show you is just the curve. And if I show you the curve, can you tell me whether or not I have a Pareto curve? See, very interesting question. So suppose I basically show that. So the interesting point is this. Suppose I show you that my Pareto curve looks like this. Would that make sense? Can that be a Pareto curve? Why not? Exactly. So, essentially, it's possible that in this picture, I can actually bring these out and give you, I mean, an attention for all you and I care is giving these three guys out and they're saying, look, you know, the curve looks reasonable. Okay. The only thing we know is that it's not syntactically wrong. Okay. It at least, so it's like, it doesn't seem to have any points where two points have the same abscissa, same x value but different y value. Our 2 points have same y value but different x value. So it looks like it is it's a Pareto curve. So none of them are actually dominated. That's good. But it's possible that all of them are dominated by somebody else above them, which he cannot show you. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's just another view of these solutions. And at least the four solutions that we output for the four different gamma values, none of them were dominated by each other. Okay. So, I pretty much did everything I wanted to do about the statistics aggregation statistics and the query processing for data aggregation. And there is some work also in query processing for the full data integration, where you not only have, basically the difference between aggregation and integration is you also have joins. Okay, so in terms of doing this sort of work for doing this kind of query processing for joins, and you know, more general queries such as joins and group by queries and aggregation queries and so on, the issues ultimately wind up being the first step is joins. Okay, and what would be the better versus worse approaches for optimizing joins. Okay. There are some interesting qualitative efforts out there in terms of how to optimize joins over data integration systems. One thing which I'll tell you before you get to go home today is, and then the qualitative work there can be compared to the qualitative work in data aggregation in the following way. Suppose if I were to say, rather than say different binding patterns have different quantitative latency values, if I say these binding patterns good, these bad, feasible, infeasible. And similarly, rather than say this is 80% coverage, this is 24% coverage, I say for this query, I'm fully covered. For this query, I'm fully covered. And the others, I have no clue. So that would be qualitative information. And you could use the qualitative information, you know, in some cases to improve your query process. Okay. So in the same way, if you have, for example, if you're in a data integration scenario and a lot of you took database courses, right? And how many join algorithms are out there? 10,000 million as far as I can tell. And each sigmoid, there would be a new join algorithm, which is a minor variation of one other join algorithm, which itself was a minor variation of some other algorithm. Okay. Joins are basically, they're all trying to decide how to do Cartesian product and do a selection. What is a join? Join is a selection over a Cartesian product between two relations. Okay, and how to do it efficiently. And for centralized databases, certain types of join algorithms are better than certain other types. Okay, and one interesting issue is in the case of data integration. So, and that's because ultimately what is better is defined in terms of which join algorithm will give you all the tuples in the lowest amount of time. Will give you all the tuples in the lowest amount of time. Now, in the case of data integration, again, there are sources out there. Suppose you're trying to join some tuples from here to some tuples from there. Okay. Now, if you have inner-outer asymmetric join, where one relation would be the inner loop, another relation would be the outer loop. God forbid your inner loop source is sleeping. It didn't send all the tuples. Then what happens? You're telling the user, wait, I'm waiting for the last tuple to come from the inner loop relation, and then I will start, you know, making the joins between outer loop relation and inner loop relation. Okay, there is an asymmetry in all these inner-outer loop joins. And the asymmetry is reasonable for a centralized database, because both of them will come at the same time, and you just decide which should be the right inner loop, which should be the right outer loop. When you have sources out there, then really either you should decide which is likely to send you the tuples faster and then put that in the inner loop, or to say to heck with it, I will have, you know, the reason you have inner and outer loops is the inner loop one would be in the main memory and the outer loop relation would be brought in from the secondary memory. That's why they differentiate it. So you could say, well, I'll take my main memory, split it into two halves, put first relation in the first half, second relation in the second half. As soon as a tuple from any of the relations comes, I'll join it with the other relation. And so this way I keep sending some tuples out to keep my irritated user on hold. This is a sigmoid paper. Okay, this is a nice idea, it turns out. I mean, you know, I made it sound as if it's just obvious, but for database people, this is revolutionary because they always thought that efficiency is in terms of total response time. And so, and if you have main memory and you have to use it in the most efficient way, put the, you know, one relation in the memory, the other relation you can bring it in. If you have enough memory to keep both, that's okay too. But what we are saying is symmetric joins are better. So there's an idea called symmetric hash join, which is what you would do if you have to do joins over sources that are distant from you. Okay, so those are the sorts of ideas that are around in terms of query processing issues for actual data integration. In fact, there's also another issue where, so suppose you have an aggregation, suppose you are supposed to compute an average over all the joined tuples, right? Once again, until all the numbers come, you can't show the average. So what do? You show a running average. Okay? And you have a JavaScript which keeps changing the average and then people feel really good. Okay, now that's fine. Suppose you say, you have a query saying, show me all the Honda Accords whose prices is lower than the average price of the Honda Accord. Because that's what everybody wants to do, right? Buy the one which is lower than the average price. Okay, now until you have the average, you can't show this guy Honda Accords. So what do? As you are computing the running average, you keep showing this guy Honda Accords. He's about to put his deposit on it, but then the average changes, so this guy has to go away. This tuple has to go away. So people come up with even more ingenious interfaces where the tuple just dissolves in front of you. Okay? Fun stuff. I mean, I think these are issues that you have to worry about. You know, these are nice things. I'll send you a link to a paper. Niagara system actually did all this stuff. Okay? And it's nice. And you wouldn't think about these being issues when you're doing, you know, state database query processing. I mean, imagine you show a tuple and just before they hold their hand, it just disappears. But that's what you have to do if you have, you know, if you have to give answers as fast as you can. Okay? So those are also issues for query processing, but that become much more relevant if you are actually trying to do joins over multiple sources. Okay? I'll write a couple of slides on that, and I'll also send you a link to this stuff. Next class onwards, we'll change topics and start talking, I think, about connections between databases and information retrieval in the context of that. Okay?